Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we're going to be talking about the financial crisis that grips not only the United States, but the world. Just today, Warren Buffett, the noted billionaire, said that this could well be the biggest financial meltdown in American history unless fast action is taken by Congress. Our guest today will talk about what sort of action Congress should take and what the causes are of this meltdown and what we ought to do about it, offering divergent perspectives from what's been heard till now. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy this show. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Remember those empty, static-filled channels on the TV dial? Those so-called white spaces may be the key to bringing high-speed broadband to the millions of Americans who are still stuck on the wrong side of the digital divide. At one time, TV technology needed to have an extra buffer on each side of a working channel to prevent interference from other stations. But technology now exists to use these spaces without harming the reception of existing channels. The Wireless Innovation Alliance is comprised of public interest groups like Public Knowledge and private tech companies like Google and Microsoft. Members want to open these unused airwaves to unlicensed devices that would provide a new way to get online. This week, they came to Capitol Hill for White Spaces Day to educate lawmakers about the need for open, unlicensed bandwidth. Timothy Carr, campaign director of Free Press, a member of the alliance, said much of the spectrum on the broadcast dial is being wasted.
And if you go to a place like Juneau, Alaska, you'll find that more than 74% of the spectrum is available for use. And even in a city as crowded as New York City, you'll find that 20% of the spectrum is available. So it presents this great opportunity to get millions of people connected.
But there are those who don't want these public airwaves to actually be used by the public.
You have very powerful corporate lobbies like the National Association of Broadcasters that wants to hoard spectrum. They want to have as much control over spectrum as possible. Even though they don't know what to do with it, they see it as a valuable asset. So they're deploying their lobbyists. They've been spending mountains of money on lawyers and misinformation campaigns to basically confuse people in Washington and to kind of manhandle and convince them that they shouldn't make this valuable spectrum available for other uses.
At the same time, the cell phone industry is pushing for the spectrum to be licensed and auctioned off to the highest bidder. But that plan would stifle new innovations and crush the promise of the airwaves that some have characterized as Wi-Fi on steroids. Carr cautions lawmakers and citizens not to be taken in by the industry spin.
It's an issue that Americans should really care about. So people in cities across the country, from Juneau to New York City, need to really get involved and tell their members of Congress that unless we use white spaces for unlicensed internet access, we are going to miss out on one of our last great opportunities to get the internet to everyone.
For more information about white spaces and links to contact your representatives, go to freepress.net/white spaces.
In South Bend, Indiana, Shores Communications owns the CBS TV affiliate, the only daily newspaper, the South Bend Tribune, the only news radio station, and another radio station. But they want even more. The company wants to buy three more TV stations, including the ABC affiliate, giving them a near total monopoly on news and information in the area. The sale would result in Shores controlling an overwhelming 81% of the South Bend news market. Media Access Project filed a petition to deny the sale with the Federal Communications Commission on behalf of the media watchdog group Free Press. Josh Luthold, a South Bend native, signed on to the petition because he feels the area is already lacking in diverse news sources.
Most of the local news is owned by just a few companies, Shirts Communications being the biggest one. The bulk of our news is from Chicago. The local stuff, it mostly gets influenced by local politics, which in this area is very conservative.
It was the news reporting in the aftermath of September 11th that got Luthold thinking about the state of the media.
That's when the big change in American policy happened. And nobody was asking anything with regards to our reaction. everybody thought it was okay that we were reacting the way we were as a country. And that's all you got from the cable news networks, and that's all you got from the local news networks around here, and that's all that came out of Chicago in this area. That's all you heard anywhere until you went online. And then if you go online and you start searching for things, you start finding all these questions that are being asked about what we're doing, about Guantanamo Bay, about everything.
He says most people don't get involved in issues like media reform because they don't know they can.
I don't know how most people's schooling, what they were taught, but typically I was taught that while we have control, no one ever explained to us how we had control. And they never said that you could write to your representative. They never showed you how to write to your representative. So things like this, when you actually find a way to be able to say something, I usually latch on to those because I feel it's important in a democracy for the people to actually have their voice heard.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Today, September 28, 2008, we're in the midst of what Warren Buffett calls possibly the worst financial disaster in the nation's history, which I think sends shivers down the spines of anyone who knows anything about American history. And fortunately today, we have two wonderful guests to join us to discuss this crisis and what's being done or not being done, what ought to be done, what ought to be considered, and what probably will be done. First with us, we have Thomas Ferguson, a professor at the University of Massachusetts at Boston of politics, co-author of one of the staple great works in American political science, Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Party Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems. Also with us today is Rob Johnson, a member of the board for the Campaign for America's Future, the Economic Policy Institute and the Democracy Alliance. Probably of most value for us in today's show because he was at one time the chief economist for the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs, and was so during the 87 stock market crash and the SNL bailout. And he has been of equal importance, a former managing director for Soros Fund Management in the 1990s, where he gained a tremendous knowledge of the financial markets. So, gentlemen, Tom Ferguson, Rob Johnson, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi there. Good afternoon.
And who was the first voice I had?
Well, that was me, I have to confess, which probably doesn't help you. It's Tom Ferguson.
Hi, Tom. And hey, Rob, how are you?
Doing well, and you?
I'm doing very well, thanks. And gentlemen, I want to thank both of you for agreeing to be on this program at such short notice. And I should let our listeners know that Tom Ferguson and Rob Johnson have written about this in the past and now have a current article at thenation.com called Bridge Loan to Nowhere, which you can go see, which was posted on September 22nd, 2008. And gentlemen, first, let's just start at the beginning, if we can, about the nature of this crisis. We hear a lot about greedy CEOs and big severance packages. Can you explain to our listeners, you know, what is the basis for the crisis and what are the dimensions of it as far as we can tell?
Yeah, could we do this by just asking the question that's probably on everybody's mind right off, which
sure.
is why are we being asked to pay for a bailout of Wall Street and the big banks?
Yeah, well, that's exactly where you cut to, you know, yeah. You're trying to shorten my show.
Yeah, well, no, don't worry. And what's more, I have no doubt, you know, we knew this is in a declining empire. You knew it was going to be bread and circuses. But right now, it's too much bread and not enough circus. We got to sort of, I think the most helpful way to think about this is that the problem is not to make Wall Street whole again or to fix it up, nor even exactly to fix up the current stockholders of the big banks. That issue keeps getting thrown in by President Bush, many Democratic leaders, but it's slurring the problem. The problem is relatively straightforward. The stuff that has to concern ordinary people is you've got to do something to reopen the money markets. Because if you don't do that, I mean, you won't be able to even get a payroll loan. Your commercial paper market won't function. I mean, just a little over a week ago, overnight lending essentially stopped between virtually all the major banks of the world. If you believe the Financial Times, there wasn't a single overnight loan between a U.S. and a European bank. I don't think that's ever happened in my adult lifetime.
And to put that in context, what would a year or two ago, what would a standard overnight, what would the amount of overnight loans be in the world economy?
It'd be billions.
It'd be trillions of dollars.
Yeah, okay, yes.
Thank you.
for this, you want scientific notation, not, you know, 10 to some power, not, we don't have to fret about, you know, what's a mere trillion in this context, and overnight loans, it's nothing. The point is that you really, this is a little bit like you got to unclog the arteries in the system. If you put it that way, you can see you probably better do something. If you don't do if you do nothing at all, you can be sure you probably will get a depression. In the sense, you can't go on like this for many weeks. I mean, right now, I know folks are having trouble getting any kind of loans. People trying to borrow money for homes just almost can't do it. Even the state of Massachusetts, I read just a couple days ago, was trying to get a loan, and the state of Massachusetts is not going to default. You know, the default risk is essentially zero, and they were quoting rates to them that were effectively three times or so what they had been just a few weeks before. And huge numbers of folks who've been trying to get, say, education loans have already discovered this. You know, you can't do it basically at any price. I mean, in the state of Massachusetts, they shut the whole Massachusetts Educational Finance Agency. Shut in the sense they're not making any loans.
I was at a congressional hearing in the House of Representatives last Friday.
And this is Rob Johnson speaking, just for the sake of listeners.
And one of the witnesses said that in the last month in Fairfax County, Virginia, 55% of the approved mortgages, when they went to closing, the bank didn't show up with the money. These are the ones that qualified that everybody thought were going to come off. And the banks didn't show. So the credit cutoff is becoming very, very acute.
So if I can sum up then, Rob Johnson and Tom Ferguson, for the general public, the lack of this credit of money availability is absolutely devastating, and the economy can't go on. And unless it's dealt with in some manner, we will almost certainly have a depression. And does it have to be dealt with in the manner being proposed?
No, that's, look, this is the next. This is the slip when you are sold the bill of goods. The Paulson, well, let's get clear as to how you might do it. What's the cause of this collapse in the credit markets is the fear that if you make an overnight loan to another bank, you won't see the money. That is, there'll be nobody around in the morning when you go to get your cash back. It's counterparty risk. Effectively, and you got to do something about that. Why? And the question is, why is all this counterparty risk out there? That's pretty straightforward. There's all this junk out there, the famous toxic waste, all the stuff that's bad, derivatives, mortgage bonds, you name it. I mean, it's often jokingly said to be radioactive. If, you know, it's not so funny, but you could probably read by it in a place like New York City if it really were radioactive at this point. So you got one way to sort of fix that is to just get rid of the junk. Just okay, and there's the sort of one solution. The Paulson plan seems to be directed toward that idea. The problem is effectively this: how much junk is out there? A safe guess is $4 or $5 trillion. I mean, that's an estimate that I saw in one bank's memo that was going around. And, you know, how much money is Paulson proposing? Well, $700 billion. Now, the Treasury has sort of admitted that it wasn't based, as they put it nicely, on any data point. It just was a big number. It's a small number, probably, for this. So it's like, in effect, the problem with the first problem with the Paulson plan as announced is that, in all probability, it's going to be like trying to fill the Pacific Ocean with basketballs. You know, no matter how many rubber companies you've got, it's probably going to take more than you can make. And that leads to the sort of obvious way you do this historically when you try to do it. The Swedes did it this way. The Germans did a variant of it in 1931, the Swedes in the early 90s. Instead of just buying assets, just going out there and buying, not quite clear what criteria they use to do that, and they're very coy about it. And of course, the Treasury wanted no restrictions at all on what it did, which probably just invites favoritism. And if you have seen the article on the front page of the New York Times today, about why they decided to rescue AIG, you'd realize that favoritism in the Treasury is maybe a very serious problem. You simply cannot leave these people to sort of just trust them and forget about it. But the question, what else can you do? Well, you can take the $700 billion and effectively put it in banks to increase their cushion. That's effectively their equity capital. I think Rob probably want to...
Well, sure. Rob, let me ask you, expand this in one second, because one of the issues I gather, Rob Johnson, is that the size of overall debt in the economy has grown so dramatically in the past two decades that the sort of financial panic that we're talking about that has always been a problem traditionally in a capitalist economy is now much greater because there's so much more debt relative to the real economy than there's ever been before. Is this an accurate observation? And if so, how much has it grown over the past few decades?
It's grown from something in the neighborhood of 80% of GDP to 350% of GDP in the last 10 or 12 years.
And GDP, for listeners who don't know,
gross domestic product, it's the size of the national economy.
It's the real economy of the world, what's produced.
And, you know, as Tom said, in essence, you got to get the blood flowing again. You got to get the credit allocation process working. And it's died because of a lack of trust. And the lack of trust is related to the deleveraging of the economy, of this big debt mountain, Bob, that you just referred to. And in that deleveraging, all the big banks look at each other, and they each want to sell assets in order to raise capital and fortify themselves. But collectively, they can't all do that, because every time one sells, he gets some capital, but the other 7 or 10 or 20 banks that are holding the same kind of capital experience a loss on their portfolio, and their capital evaporates.
Yeah, I think
so they're kind of playing musical chairs.
You probably want to just make it clear here for your listeners that deleveraging means you're effectively borrowing less relative to your size.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the as Tom said, leverage is, in a sense, the size of the total debt relative to your capital. It's a ratio. It's got the top and the bottom in the math. So what they're saying is, what Tom has said and what I agree with, is injecting capital is reducing the ratio by increasing the bottom as opposed to selling assets, which is another way of accomplishing deleveraging. Deleveraging, when balance sheets are very complex and all these rocket scientists have built all these crazy derivatives, is scary. And nobody knows how to assess each other, and hence the credit market is frozen up. Paulson wanted us to trust him. He wanted us to believe that somehow he could figure out the value of these things and protect taxpayers. And yet, off the record, many people believe the Treasury felt like, well, they're just going to go overpay for these assets. And when they overpay for them, then the banks will have more capital and liquidity. I think it's much better for the health of the system to inject equity so that they don't feel compelled to sell these assets and bring down this mountain of leverage too rapidly. But secondly, it gives the taxpayer some ownership in the resulting institution, and it comes at the expense of existing stockholders and perhaps existing bondholders who could be forced to do a debt-to-equity swap. And the result would be much less burden borne by the taxpayers and much more burden borne by the people who made who were the genesis of the problem.
Yeah, could we just back up for a second?
I mean, sure thing. Go ahead, Tom Ferguson.
In effect, the proposition here is, look, you got two choices. You can either blow this cash out on assets, which will just, you know, throw basketballs in the Pacific for a month or two, or if you make them dribble it out slower, as the Congress seems inclined to do, you can do it sort of in dribbles. Or you can actually try to go fix the problem by taking equity in the banks. Now, the trick here is you don't have to do that for free. You don't have to give away the cash. You would end up owning the banks. And then you don't have to run them forever. We're not proposing to sort of restart the Soviet Union or something like that, although Paulson's scheme may yet end up in something like that, because I think when it does fail, they probably will end up nationalizing all the banks. But if you take equity in the banks, you do exactly what the Swedes did. When you take all the dark matter, the toxic waste over, you often hear that called the bad bank. When you do bank bailouts like this, the bad banks always lose money. But you can make a ton of the money back, in some cases all of it, because when you sell off the equity, you get the cash value of the stock, which has gone up. You know, it's just a couple of weeks ago, or last week, when they announced this plan, you could see how world stock markets jumped. All the gains to that jump in the stock market came to private shareholders around the world. There's just no reason. Effectively, what Rob and I are telling you is you can recycle some of those gains back into the Treasury of the United States, to the people of the United States, whose money would be making this all possible.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to, Thomas Ferguson, a professor at the University of Massachusetts at Boston, Robert Johnson, who's also joining us, who is a former financial impresario, I guess, with George Soros, worked as a chief economist for the Banking Committee in the Senate, and is currently very active in American politics. Both of them recently co-authored an article, Bridge Loan to Nowhere, which was published in The Nation just a few days ago, and they've written widely in the past on these issues. Our number here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455. That's our local number, and then our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Gentlemen, if I can sum up so far for the sake of listeners who might not have that much experience with the business pages or economics, as you see it, there are basically two fundamental ways to go for a society to deal with a crisis like this. One is the route favored by Paulson and that it looks like Congress will approve, which is basically to do a bailout, to buy up the lousy loans and hope you can stem it that way, but basically not change the system otherwise and hope you don't have to keep pouring money into it or basketballs into the Pacific. And I'll let you talk about this in a second, Tom, but it sounds like you're pessimistic about that being successful, even at $700 billion. The other option is what you call inject equity, or in lay terms, the government would basically buy up these banks, which have the bad banks and lending institutions that have very low share prices now, buy them up, take over them, as Sweden did in the early 1990s, and then eventually sell them when they get back to profitability. Is that a fair way to summarize it?
Yes, it's almost analogous to what Warren Buffett did with Goldman Sachs last week. What we feel is that if you were to say this was a private business deal,
yeah,
we hired Warren Buffett to represent the taxpayers. The tax base is the strong hand. Wall Street is the weak hand. If a Warren Buffett were going to do a restructuring with these weak companies on behalf of his investment fund, he would probably take preferred stock as what we call the equity injection. He would probably limit the compensation of management. He would probably sell off some assets, and you would get a proper rate of return and take control of the company, and existing stock and bondholders would be hurt. What we need from the Senate and from the House and from the Treasury is to represent the American people as if they were Warren Buffett.
You know, Rob Johnson, now that you mentioned that, Warren Buffett has been an advisor to Senator Barack Obama, just meeting with him last week on this issue. I don't get a sense that Barack Obama or the leaders of the Democratic Party in Congress are very interested in injecting equity, in taking the sort of step a business person would take were they entering this market, but instead seem to be very comfortable with the Paulson-Bernanke approach. Do you think that's an accurate assessment?
I think that's a somewhat accurate assessment. I believe if I were to be critical, Congressman Frank and Senator Dodd and their committees have given Paulson a little too much from his first plan that would have been, how would I say, his dead-on arrival. I would have just scrubbed it and started over from that position like Tom and I advocate. But I will give particularly Senator Dodd and his staff credit. I was down in Washington and corresponding with many of the members of the staff on both sides, and they did bring in equity, and there is some representation of equity in the mix right now.
The issue here is it mandatory or optional?
Right.
And basically, in the current bill, it's optional. At one point, when it came out the other day from the Senate staff, exactly as Rob suggests, it was mandatory. I regret to say that Barney Frank, who has been good on other issues, notably the question of letting bankruptcy judges transform the terms of mortgages, on this, he dropped the ball completely. And the Frank and Congressman Frank and his staff have been the biggest obstacle to this on the Democratic side. I think Senator Obama's principles that I saw mention equity, but they are weaselly on the question of, is it optional or mandatory? Bluntly, it should be mandatory. It's our cash. We should get something back for it. We shouldn't have to give any of it away. It's like you don't have to employ Warren Buffett half-time, as it were. But there is an equity provision in there, albeit now a greatly weakened one. And, of course, I mean, to be sort of fair about this, the Republicans have, as far as I know, uniformly rejected equity, except the House Republicans have proposed letting private equity firms take over banks, which is a whole nest of another problems, which we could discuss maybe later. But the Democratic record on this is mixed. The Republican record from this standpoint, I think, is just uniformly dismal.
On that note, let's go to the phone lines where we have callers waiting. I know there's tremendous interest in this issue in our listening audience. And let me repeat the numbers, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Now let's go to our first caller, line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Tom Ferguson and Rob Johnson.
Thank you. I, a couple of days ago, saw a proposal I really liked by Tom Hartman on CommonDreams.org, where basically he was putting forward something that has a long-tested track record. We used it to help pay for the Spanish-American War, part of the Civil War. It was used during the Depression. In fact, it was on the books here until 1966, and a lot of European and Asian countries still use this source of revenue. It's securities turnover excise tax. And basically how that would work is you'd put, say, you set that anywhere you want, but say a 0.25% tax on every stock, swap, derivative, and other kinds of trading of securities. And he says this would probably generate somewhere in the terms of $150 billion in the first year, and that, you know, you could use this to help repay the Treasury after setting up, some sort of institution to help, you know, put the money out to take care of this problem in the first place. But he says it also would have the benefit of tamping down toxic speculation, because all of a sudden, where, you know, people had really no cost of gambling on these kinds of things, there would suddenly be a cost to trading, and that would, you know, tend to people to focus on long-term value rather than some kind of short-term speculation.
Gentlemen, you want to respond to that?
Well, I would say what many in the economics profession call a Tobin tax is something, I would say, if implemented, would generate a great deal of revenue. And as the listener who called in suggested, it would put the burden on those people who have created the mess.
And Rob and Tom, if I can add, I've read your piece and I know your work in other areas. I mean, you, in addition to an equity stake, you make it clear in your piece that we need to return to serious regulation of financial markets.
Well, yeah, we also discuss the tax story, too. I mean, it's just, you know, when you have to make a choice for 15 or 20 minutes on a program, what do you emphasize? We thought they're deciding today the shape of the bill. Let's just talk about the tax story for a minute. What you have in effect here, notice first of all, is, you know, we were all thinking at the start of the election this might be the year single-payer insurance came to America. We were all thinking health insurance. Stupid us. I mean, the single-payer insurance has come for sick financial companies, okay? And so you know that that's, yes, it's expensive. Now, the question is how are you going to pay for it? Remember, we were kept being told we couldn't, a single-payer would be too expensive, blah, 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 for health. Now they want to throw many times more money off on finances. So, yeah, the tax question seems to me to be just totally appropriate. Now, I mean, if you just think of this in sort of basics, it's not true that most people own very much stock, even in their pension funds. You know, large chunks of folks have no pensions at all. So in that sense, boy, I have no trouble with the idea of a tax that fell on folks who are heavily into stocks and bonds. And that's a good one, though. I would want to think about whether that wouldn't discourage some types of transactions you might want. I'm quite open to it. There's stuff in the current tax code, notably this thing called carried interest, which private equity firms exploit to drop their tax rates to about half of what they should be. I mean, the carried interest provision should just be repealed. And I actually don't understand why the Democrats, well, I do understand it. Okay, I do politics and money. But I don't understand why the Democrats have not made more out of this. And there is, of course, the problem of income taxes. You know, the Bush tax cuts are due to expire in 2010. One of the more amazing things one of the original House Republican proposals was that they were proposing to drop the capital gains tax for a while to zero. You know, I try to figure out what on earth are these folks thinking about? I mean, it'll allow you to just dump every asset you've got through the last 10 years. It's sort of like the exclamation point to the whole Reagan era in American politics. You get out the door at 0% capital gains tax. I mean, what on earth are they thinking? My sense is that any reasonable tax restructuring that threw a modest burden upstairs, I don't favor soak the rich, and I don't see the point of it. Our tax system is so far out of line with both equity and common sense that you could fairly easily fix that problem. I'm very sympathetic to the listener's general concern.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guests today, Thomas Ferguson and Robert Johnson, co-authors of a recent piece in The Nation and experts on politics and finance. Now let's go to line two. Mylon, you're on the air with Ferguson and Johnson.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, can you talk a little bit about how the final bill might address this transfer of power from Congress to the Secretary of the Treasury? That is very concerning to me, and it seems like they want to give him too much power, and then he's going to go ahead and turn around and allocate the billions of dollars we give him to his friends and choose what financial institutions survive and which ones don't. Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
I would say that the listener's question is really at the heart of the matter. How are these resources to be transferred and to whom? Tom spoke of the article regarding AIG and its bailout today and who was present at the time that that was decided. Tom, my co-author, has written a great deal about the role of money in politics. I spoke earlier in this hour about what if Warren Buffett represented us. Unfortunately, the people who pay for the politicians through campaign finance donations and enormous fundraisers are the people who are in need here, not the taxpayers. And so it's as if the investment bankers are representing the wrong team in the transaction.
And if I could just add one thing in here while you're answering this, Rob, it is a little disconcerting that Henry Paulson was in favor of increasing deregulation to right at, while this process, you know, process of this crisis was unfolding until quite recently.
That's correct. They were in the process of doing a study to argue that everybody would move from New York to London in the financial industry if they didn't deregulate yet more. I wouldn't worry too much about business moving to London just this second.
No, I don't think so either. But I mean, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Rob, but I mean, it seems that giving someone like Paulson unchecked power seems on the surface to be somewhat questionable.
Yes, and the caller's question, I'll come try to be more precise. The Senate and House have worked very hard to diminish his discretion, introduce oversight and other things. But with these crazy assets, these complex mortgages and this alphabet soup of derivatives, it's very hard to believe that Paulson would be doing something that represented fair value. But at some level, like I said earlier, I wish the House and Senate had just set aside Paulson's plan rather than try to claw back some oversight discretion, putting things on a website and what have you. At some level, you can complain about the problem after the deal's done. but you're not constraining the actions sufficiently.
You know, Rob, I follow this as a news consumer and follow the news, and I see about the Republican Party having sort of a dissident branch that's raising hell and trying to blow up the deal. But I see a lot less on the Democratic side of progressive Democrats who are sort of trying to change the deal dramatically. Is this going on behind the scenes, and we're just not hearing much about it?
Oh, clearly there are progressive Democrats who are very unhappy with what's taking place. But they are often encouraged to be part of the what you might call moderate or centrist coalition and not to express their concerns.
Yeah, there's a couple of issues here. One is the Democratic leadership, especially Rahm Emanuel, has been working overtime to sort of smother any sort of progressive interest. My understanding is he was blocking off progressive economists from even addressing the House Democrats in the final stages of this. And good old Rahm Emanuel was, in fact, director of, I think, Freddie Mac at one point. I think, really, there is a problem with the House Democratic leadership, though, of course, you got to then ask, why do the progressives in the House caucus hew so closely to that? Now, part of that problem is the mix of media and money. You know, and the media reporting here is, in general, over the week or two, you can see that even in both the national and the international press, people have sort of figured out the advantages of equity. But the reporters doing the day-to-day reporting are not paying close enough attention, and they are allowing these guys to slur some very important distinctions. In particular, both the Democrats and the Republicans love to say, we've got an equity provision in the bill. It's just not mandatory. They don't say that, and the reporters don't think to pick up on it. I mean, a couple of times I've talked to reporters, and I've said, did you ask them if it was mandatory? And said, no. I mean, you can't ask the population to sort of do a whole lot better than the national press. And the national press on this one is dropping the ball.
Well, on that note, let's go back to our phone lines. I think we have callers eager to ask you experts the question. Our guests here on Media Matters, Tom Ferguson and Robert Johnson. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Now let's go to line three. Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, when people talk about Henry Paulson's bio, they refer to his coming from Goldman Sachs, but the U.S. Treasury bio has him working for the Nixon administration in 72, 73, and before that in the Department of Defense, and that some sources say that he was working for John Ehrlichman. That was his job. When he was in the White House counsel. So I guess I'm wondering why this was never reported and who is this man?
Well, thank you very much, caller. Tom, Rob, do either of you want to field this?
I can't state one way or the other on those particular facts and thus be very reluctant to comment. In general, anybody who charges the U.S. press with failure to report significant facts is almost never going to be wrong. But at this point, I'd sort of say the type of stuff you finally see on page one of the New York Times, I mean, it is something of a first, where the former head of Goldman Sachs, i.e. the Treasury Secretary, and the existing head of Goldman Sachs, it is being suggested right in public, were effectively making public policy on behalf of that firm just a week or two ago. That sort of thing, that's one does need to sort of concentrate on this stuff. I can't comment on John Ehrlichman and Hank Paulson and don't speculate as a matter of principle.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. We have callers waiting patiently. Line four, Urbana, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I was trying to focus on what action I might be able to personally take in this matter as far as it sounds like a really good idea to me to have mandatory equity injection, as you guys have mentioned. I guess I'm trying to figure out from your conversation if that's pretty much a pipe dream at this point. You're going to have to stick with the plan they've already come up with, and maybe if I want to complain to my senators and congressmen about this, as far as maybe I can just try to complain about having more of a mandatory item in there? Or what do you guys think of, as far as the strategy for me personally and for other people out there who might want to take some action on this?
I would always incur more action rather than less. I know it feels at times frustrating because you don't think your action will get any results, but this is a major, major event in American political history, and I would encourage you to put a very loud voice forward. This bill will probably be voted on in the next 2 to 3 days. My sense, as Tom alluded to earlier, the Republican caucus has not yet signed on. Many Democrats in the House are still scared. Everybody faces the voters in 5 weeks. I think the more voters make their feelings known, the more likely we are to see adjustments in a healthy direction in that bill over the next 2 to 3 days.
Yeah, Tom and Rob, let me just do a little follow-up on this. I think, Tom, earlier you suggested that the bill is currently, that you've seen so far, that you expect, barring changes in the next few days, probably will be insufficient to get the job done. We'll have to pay more, or the crisis could just, you know, go out of control, and they'll have to come up with something else at some point in the next few months.
Yeah, they made that sort of as a follow-on to the questioner's, to Rob's answer to the questioner,
yeah,
which is you may get a second fly at this. I hope not, but you know, it's hard to see how spending $700 billion on asset buying is going to cure this. And I bet for sure it won't. On the other hand, it may be that Paulson's going to spend most of it on some form of equity capital, though. I mean, that'll force him to actually, and then just not find a way to give it to him as equity without taking equity for the population. That will at least keep the banks sound. It will not get our money back. You may get a second fly on this. I hope not. I mean, it would be nice if it works, but $700 billion just blown out the markets there is clearly not going to do it. And, I think that's so clear that I don't mind saying, watch, there will be more going here.
Our guest today, who you just listened to, Tom Ferguson. We also have Robert Johnson, authors of the new piece, Bridge Loan to Nowhere in the Nation, experts on politics and the financial system. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We have a couple phone lines open at 333-9455 and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. I'm going to try to get to all the callers today. I know there's tremendous interest in this subject, and we're very fortunate to have two experts with us. Let's now go to line one. Lafayette, Indiana, you're on the air with Ferguson and Johnson.
It seems to me that the problem with bank liquidity can be solved if the banks simply borrow from the Federal Reserve and use the so-called toxic waste as collateral. I know the Fed has been disappointed by the lack of borrowing, and they started auctions as a way of trying to encourage more borrowing, and that still seems to be insufficient. But the Fed can accept the collateral, the so-called toxic waste. All the banks need to do is to be willing to borrow it and let the Fed create money on demand.
Rob may want to comment on this, but I think the short answer to that is, some weeks ago, the Fed has been systematically relaxing its collateral requirements for a while, and now it's accepting just about anything. That's not preventing the lockup in the markets. Your problem is, the Fed can in effect sort of operate as a substitute interbank market for a bit.
But I think that the problem has been the banks weren't willing to get their loans from the Fed because they didn't want to be known as needing it.
Well, that's the primary dealer's business that they haven't used, but they have certainly made use in very large amounts. I mean, I think last week, I think the Fed let something like $188 billion in short-term lending. Your problem is if the bank disappears, having taken the loan from the Fed, the other bank that is holding the loan is still stuck with a problem. I mean, you got to sort of deal with that question. It's not enough to just sort of keep putting cash into individual banks. They put enormous amounts in, and nobody is willing to move.
I mean, what in effect has happened is that the bank interbank market, the market between banks, has broken down from lack of trust. So everybody is dealing with the Federal Reserve as their bank, and they've very nearly, along the lines that the caller suggested, they've nearly exhausted their balance sheet at this point. They're studying ways in which to not ignite fears of inflation, which would make mortgage rates go up, to expand the Federal Reserve's balance sheet right now, because they have used that facility. It has not restored trust between the one bank and the other, because these toxic losses that are very difficult to analyze and understand still are like a cloud hanging over the entire banking system.
As I understand it, the Federal Reserve has the unlimited ability to make loans and take collateral, and if the banks don't borrow from each other and borrow from the Fed instead, you still have the same amount of money in circulation. It's just that it's all being borrowed from the Fed instead of from each other.
But they aren't lending it once they take it in. They're hoarding liquidity for fear of the deeper downturn coming. So, yes, they do take liquidity from the Fed, but they keep it in their vaults rather than expand credit to creditworthy borrowers in, non-financial businesses.
So that's where the problem comes in, is they're not willing to loan out the money that they can, in fact, get from the Fed.
This is what John Maynard Keynes once famously called pushing on a string.
That's absolutely right, and thank you very much, caller. Let's go now to our next caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Thomas Ferguson and Robert Johnson.
Two quick comments and a question. First of all, if the public does not have a mandatory interest, then this is a further prescription for failure. Second, Jay Leno made a very telling comment a few nights ago when he said a failed president and a failed Congress want to invest billions of dollars in bankrupt firms. What can go wrong? Now my question is, would you comment on the implications of the inflationary pressure of this bill when it's passed? It seems to me that the dollar will go down upon passage, the gas prices will go up, and because energy is such an intrinsic part of our economy, that this will fuel inflation quite a bit. I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much.
I would start by saying that the purpose of any bailout, a good one or a bad one, is to arrest deflationary influences. And it is only if this plan fails and then the Federal Reserve resorts to printing money very rapidly
with
those inflationary consequences follow on. But I don't think a bailout itself properly structured is anything other than an anecdote to deflation at this point in time.
Rob, this is Bob McChesney back here again. The callers are making such great questions. I could have had a lemonade and sat back today. But even in the best-case scenario, assuming the Paulson plan, the one that Congress is doctoring, gets passed, assuming it somehow works and we don't have a financial meltdown and the credit markets start up again and go back to work, and let's assume that we only have to spend, say, $1 trillion total to make it work. Even in the best case scenario, we're looking at a fairly sluggish economy, and the cost to the American people will be a lower standard of living. Is that correct?
I suspect that's correct, but I think Tom, please pipe in on this.
Yeah.
I think not doing a bailout is one of those negative sum losses, and the standard of living would fall further and more rapidly if there is not some sort of intervention.
No, that's why I said the best case scenario.
You got to distinguish two issues here, and actually it's good to sort of have this point come up because this has been an issue in the bailout negotiations. One is you got to get the bloodstream working again. If you get the bloodstream working again, there's still the question of, if you like, the health of the patient or just in this case the health of the economy. There you clearly need, it seems to us, you're looking at the beginning of a sharp downturn. It's obvious that this is hitting the real economy hard. That's simply because when you stop the bloodstream, it hits all the organs pretty hard. But just picking up the bloodstream won't get you the level of national income back to full employment. They need a stimulus package. I don't, exactly like Rob said, I don't take too seriously worries about inflation right now. You get worried about inflation when they blow this whole program. But they're going to have to do something to stimulate the economy. They need a fairly large fiscal stimulus. And one of the more depressing things is the way the fiscal stimulus issue has been allowed to drop out. The House Republicans didn't want any. The administration, as far as I can tell, didn't want any, although I think Paulson was willing. He signaled he might take a small $50 billion one, which is nothing. But the shocking thing is the way the Democrats have just sort of walked away on this. I mean, it's not enough to say that we're doing this because we really need to reach agreement with the Republicans. They need to fix the economy, and they've got majorities in both the House and the Senate. They could clearly explain to us all the problem of an economic stimulus. And they need a big one, a really large one, to tide you over. I mean, this is it doesn't mean you perpetually increase the size of the budget deficit. You know, you want to be running budget deficits when you're below full employment and closing them as you come back to full employment.
What we have here is a crisis, and a crisis like Naomi Klein talks about in her new book, The Shock Doctrine, is an opportunity for changing the rules of the game. And the Treasury and the White House are using this shock to try to disorient people and to create what you might say a restructuring of the rules that gave them more authority, more discretion, and didn't take care of Main Street. As Tom said, I would hope that the Democratic Congress and Senator Obama would meet that challenge with an alternative vision, and that would necessitate a much more significant fiscal stimulus to promote growth and infrastructure development.
Yeah, could we? Yeah, we might just follow up here. There's two things you can obviously do to get a fiscal stimulus going nicely quickly. One is it's clear that states and localities need substantial funds. I mean, you got canceled transportation projects, schools, and things like that all over the place now. As the states move into big deficits, they need help from the federal government on that. And then you can do something on a sort of homeowners loan corporation or mortgage relief. I think is best looked at in the context of the stimulus program, rather than in the narrow context of the bank bailout. There's a tendency to put them together, and it's being used almost as a cloak for folks to fool people. I mean, you grab for the sheepskin of mortgage program as you rush out naked to the public with your non-mandatory equity program. That's not good enough. But the case for a substantial fiscal stimulus is, I think, quite compelling at this point. And you just break it up between states and localities and direct mortgage relief. Homeowners Loan Corporation is an excellent model. There are others.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Thomas Ferguson, you've just been listening to, and Robert Johnson. We've only got about 5 minutes left. We're talking about the financial crisis and the crisis of the economy. Let's go to two callers who've been waiting patiently. First, let's go to line three, Champaign County. You're on the air.
Hi. On this last subject, I'm wondering if, if you set aside the people that are flipping and the malignant kind of loans that probably ought to go to the district attorney instead of anywhere else, that you just sort of put bridging loans in to keep people in their houses. That takes those houses off the books. But I wonder how much of this is really housing. And since the way the thing is written, he could be bailing out the credit default swap market on the pretext that this is all a housing crisis. Now, I'm not saying the housing, these structured investment vehicles and all this gibberish that I've been trying to figure out isn't a large part of it, but it seems to me that there might be a bit of bait and switch going on. That they're actually, and since the reason why that's possible to say is that this whole you can't even get a solid figure on how much of these kind of off the debts the derivatives represent, the credit default part anyway.
Well, caller,
can you kind of sort that out? There's another thing. Mark to market is the one of the mantras of the House Republicans led by Gingrich, and if they aren't going to accept that as a figure for what the values are, what are they going to accept? I can't sort it out. So I'm asking you to try.
Well, thank you very much, Rob Johnson, Tom
sure.
Ferguson.
Sure. First of all, I want to say to the caller, you're not alone in not being able to sort it out. I've talked to people in some of the major banks who are principal brand names in this crisis, loaded up with complex derivatives, credit default swaps, and all the structured investment vehicles that he's confused by, and they admit to me privately that they don't even know how to measure what's in their own book. This brings a question forward that I know Tom has really emphasized, which is we've had these rocket scientists building mark-to-model and pretending it was marked to market. But there has been no market for these instruments. And when everybody came out from behind the curtain and found there was no wizard, we found that many of these assets were worth 22 cents on the dollar rather than a dollar on the dollar. And that's a very, very serious breach of trust that contributed to the fear that's led to this spiraling credit deleveraging and stress.
We've got three callers waiting patiently. I don't know if we'll be able to get to all of them, but I do want to try. But real quickly before we do, Tom Ferguson, I had someone email in and ask me, what is equity?
Equity is the stock ownership in the company.
Okay, that's nice and simple. That's exactly right. Now, I'm not quizzing you. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line four, Farina, you're on the air with Tom Ferguson and Rob Johnson.
Hi, thank you very much for another interesting show. That last caller brought up some real good points there. That mark-to-market thing, isn't that at the heart of the Enron criminality? And I've heard there's over 40 FBI investigations current on this problem. Could you give an estimate of how much of this is actual criminality, and how much is because they changed the laws in the banking system in the last 15 years? Thank you.
Thank you, caller.
That question is unfair in the following six cents. I mean, if you look at the massive litigation coming out of the earlier stock market bubble debris, what you'll often find is that the appeals court set aside the verdicts at some point or another. And so stuff you'd say is obviously criminal behavior, like banks abetting Enron's special purpose vehicles, turned out not to be criminal behavior. And so, you know, asking us, with the target moving that rapidly, while everybody's sitting around talking about judges making law, you know, you're not hearing about this. It's hard, man. That would be you need the deity. This is not a question we can try to sort the balance between genuine criminality and merely completely legal,
But how much, then, can we attribute, say, to deregulation and the loosening up of any
sort
of...
That's different. That's different. Look, this crisis would not have occurred without the deregulation movement that sort of seized the U.S. From the 70s on. There's just no way you can get around the whole... The way you turned the mortgage crisis... You know, could have been averted if the Fed under Greenspan had just exercised its authority under the 1994 Homeowners Protection Act to a considerable extent. Wouldn't have stopped everything, but would have stopped a lot. If you'd then gone on to regulate derivatives, the way you turn this into a world crisis is you take those mortgage bonds and then you slice and dice them into very fancy high-octane derivatives and sell them around the place. Those then collapse, and suddenly everybody's got losses, and they're all leveraged 50 to 1. The rules that allowed, say, the net capital rule and the Securities and Exchange Commission, when it changed it in 2004, that allowed you to go from something like 12 to 1 to 50 to 1 leverage if you're an investment house.
Tom Ferguson, unfortunately, I've got to stop you. I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio.
Sure.
I want to apologize to the two callers I didn't get to or any more that might be trying to call. The good news is next week we'll be back with another show on this subject. Right now, though, I'd like to thank Robert Johnson and Thomas Ferguson for joining me today on Media Matters. Thank you very much, guys. You've been great.
Thank you.
I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for the great work he's done. And thank you, dear listeners. Let's be back in 167 hours.